Welcome back to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. Today's lecture, Ecological Biochemistry, is perhaps a very interesting one for most students. What we're going to talk about today is a little bit of what I'll call the popularized version of toxicology, where we talk about poisons, especially natural-based poisons. Unbeknownst to many of us, the natural world is undergoing very dramatic chemical warfare. Species interactions, species challenges, species survival in terms of chemicals and chemical warfare. There's also a lot of biochemical synthesis that is used for communication, for fundamental molecular processes in various species. Some of these are non-toxic, but some of them as well are toxic. What's interesting to us as being predators or part of the food ecology, the ecology of food, the fact that we in fact are a part of a food chain, hopefully our own, is that these chemicals have the potential to impact us. What we're going to try to do is put this in a very broad context, the context of ecology, the context of biochemistry as it relates to ecology. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to have you do is define ecological biochemistry. So we'll give you just a quick definition. For those of you that have not studied ecology, we're not going to try to get into the large range of adaptive and ecological definition that we might have out there. We would like to have you explain biochemical adaptation and the roles of secondary compounds. In fact, if we look from an evolutionary basis, how have plants and animals adapted to the natural world around them? For example, plants. Plants don't move, and we'll talk about the fact that, in fact, a place on the food chain where you can't run away from your predator is, in fact, a very precarious position. So how have plants actually adapted, and how perhaps have they developed these secondary compounds? And we'll define what these secondary compounds are in terms of plant systems. We'll try as well to have you describe the detoxification primary metabolic pathways in plants and animals. Now, in our earlier lectures, we went through quite a bit about biotransformation, and so you kind of know and understand what organisms do, and especially what we do, in terms of transforming chemical toxicants to try to eliminate them, to detoxify them, so in fact they don't have a toxic end effect on us. Well, what about a plant system? And we'll talk about some of the differences and some of the similarities that plants have with our own biotransformation. We'd like to have you explain the key processes and factors involved in biotransformation and biodegradation. Those of you that know a little bit about microbiology, biodegradation, and some of the processes out there know that, in fact, microbes eat, and sometimes they eat things that are toxic. In fact, microbes have a remarkable ability to mutate and adjust to their environments as a key survival mechanism. And if that environment is potentially toxic, what can happen is that the high metabolic turnover, the high mutation capability of microbes can actually yield a situation where a chemical that was once toxic tomorrow becomes lunch, in fact. We'll try to have you explain and explore the concepts of sequestration, which you kind of know and understand because our body fats sequester chemical toxicants, bioaccumulate, how an organism can accumulate, especially when we look at it from a food chain basis, and also biomagnification, how we magnify up a food chain in terms of the overall concentrations of a toxicant within a trophic food chain. We'll try to have you contrast different forms of ecological biochemical interaction, and we'll do this with a couple of case studies or examples that I hope you'll find quite interesting. Well, it's a good idea to define biochemistry from an ecological perspective. Ecological biochemistry is a coupling of the observational science of ecology with the molecular science of biochemistry. Okay, so we're looking at ecology. And what is ecology? Ecos, the Greek word, means household. Ecology is essentially the study of the household of nature. If we are to understand ecology, we need to understand ecological interaction among all of the plant and animal kingdoms. So we have animals and fungi, plants, protists and monera. These are the five kingdoms. They all have the ability to interact. I always like to ask students, when you reflect on yesterday and what you ate yesterday, how many of the different plant and animal kingdoms did you feed from? In other words, did you have some chicken? Did you couple that with a spinach salad and perhaps have some mushrooms on your spinach salad? And then unbeknownst to you, perhaps there was some microbial contamination. So I would suspect that many of us dine regularly on all of the kingdoms in ecology. In terms of ecological biochemistry, what we're very interested in is the synthesis and transformation of chemicals in the environment. Some of these are as a result of the processes in an organism, and it has been hypothesized that we have many of these biochemicals and chemicals developed to aid a species in survival. Now, we don't know that in particular with some of these chemical compounds, but we can look at the development of specific compounds like toxins and venoms, especially toxins and venoms that are used in an offensive way or a defensive way in terms of battling, in terms of survival of a species when there actually is overt biochemical warfare. There is the potential in ecological biochemistry to have biochemical adaptation. And this is a fact that can happen as a result of biosynthesis. Have you ever asked yourself why certain plants have poisons or certain animals have poisons? What was the selection process that took place? Why are those particular flavors or smells associated with a particular animal or plant? Is it a flavor or a smell to make it desirable so that in fact we eat it and then deposit the seed pods when we go through the process of elimination and therefore spread the seed of this particular plant around? There are many in terms of ecological biochemistry that think that this is one of the survival strategies, for example, of plants that are relatively immobile. We can have detoxification processes in ecological biochemistry. We have tremendous enzymatic pathways and chemical transformation pathways. We reviewed several of them in, I believe it was lecture 8, where we talked about biotransformation. We saw and listed many of the enzymes, many of the cofactors that mammals use in biodegradation, in how we transform or degrade or change chemicals to allow them to be a bit more soluble and in many cases easily eliminated. In microbes, there is also the potential for biodegradation and the conversion of these food substrates all the way to carbon dioxide and water. So we take an organic compound on one side of the reaction, and through these detoxification biodegradation reactions have nothing but carbon dioxide and water on the other side, a complete oxidation chemistry. We can also see in terms of ecological biochemistry, bioaccumulation and biomagnification up the food chain, and we'll talk about those in some of the examples during today's lecture. We also can look at ecological biochemical interaction. What happens, for example, when we find that certain species actually require the chemicals produced by another species in terms of their own survival? So there is a potential for what has been referred to as coevolution, where there's a symbiotic relationship between two types of species, two types of organisms that require each other for success in terms of the overall competitive strategy of each. Now, biochemical adaptation can be defined as the metabolic flexibility of a living organism to fit into a changing environment, thus improving their chances for survival and reproduction. Now, why do we have this biochemical adaptation? There's two basic time-based pathways. One is evolution, and in evolution we have many, many generations. And so as the tree splits off, some of these mutations, some of these changes will allow for a higher degree of adaptability. For example, many animals that had to adapt to various ice ages, climate changes, that didn't have the necessary body fat, the metabolics, or the fur would not be successful in this overall evolutionary adaptation. We also have a shorter term acclimatization, and this process happens typically within the lifetime of an individual. And so this is usually a low dose, low toxicity, low lethality threshold. It's a challenge, and then the organism has a chance to adapt to this particular chemical or physical challenge. Now think about that. If we're constantly biotransforming many of the chemical challenges that we have via enzyme systems, if we teach our system via constant low-dose pressure or stress, we can have the situation develop where we have a higher level of certain types of enzymes. Our enzyme levels adapt, they acclimatize, and that's within one generation, within the lifetime. So that's an individual base, whereas evolution will be more of a population base. We as scientists have a challenge, and our challenge is to decipher the strategy of the natural world. If you look around, you try and make sense of all the bright colors, all the flavors, all the smells, all the toxins that appear to us in the natural world. We can look at it in terms of competitive but also assistive pathways. Now, I like to use the example of drug and drug type compounds, these neurotoxins, and I'm going to give the example of THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active ingredient in the marijuana plant. Now think about this. Why does the marijuana plant actually have a chemical compound that essentially can change the mental state of a higher animal? Now think about this for a second. This isn't just for the case for the entertainment or recreation of some folks that like recreational drugs. If you look at it in a natural context, perhaps you can kind of take a look at this as the plant itself may be making herbivores a little bit high that feed on it. You feed too much on the marijuana plant, and you, as an herbivore, then become easy prey for a higher predator. And so if, for example, animals are grazing, and they're grazing on this particular plant, they too then become stoned, and as a stoned animal in a dog-eat-dog's world, they become better prey, and so it does adjust the balance. And so this might be one way to look at the strategy of this particular plant in having a neurotoxin available, a somewhat pleasant neurotoxin. It is not necessarily bitter or repulsive to the animal, but in fact it changes its mental state, makes it easier prey. One of the things we have to look at in ecological biochemistry from a contextual point of view is the potential for competitive and also symbiotic interactions, and these can be interactions that are plant to plant, and these can be, for example, one plant trying to outcompete another plant. If you are a gardener, you probably scratch your head and or you get puzzled like myself at why weeds seem to thrive so well, seem to be so drought tolerant, seem to grow so much easier than the cultivated species that I'd like to grow in terms of my fruits and vegetables. What's the competitive strategy of the weed as opposed to perhaps the less competitive fruit or vegetable that I'm trying to grow? And you can also take a look at competitive interactions in terms of plant-animal interrelationships. Are there specific plants that certain species of animals will feed on? Because not because of the nutritive qualities, the fact that they get carbohydrates, proteins, and fats from these plants, but because they get selective dosing of specific secondary plant compounds. These secondary plant compounds are not the proteins, carbohydrates, and fats that we would need as energy resources. These are other chemicals. These are the chemicals that, for instance, give it color, flavor, taste, bitterness, toxicity. In terms of animal-animal interactions, we can see in terms of our own personal history and observations of the natural world the presentation of various venoms and toxins. Many of us have been bit by a spider, stung by a bee, and we've experienced these animal-to-animal venoms and toxins in a very direct way. Some of these, again, can be offensive weapons in terms of a strategy to immobilize prey. Another can be a defensive strategy in terms of trying to paralyze or harm the animal sufficiently so that they can get away and run and hide. Now, some of these toxins need to be related to the particular animal or plant's survival strategy. Organisms often synthesize or use these various toxins in their survival strategy. And an interesting quote here is Manfini in 1975. And as I said, as in terms of leading up to this, one has to kind of wonder about this challenge of plants to survive being the fact that they are largely mobile. In Feeney's words, the most conspicuous non-event in the history of the angiosperms is the failure of insects and other herbivores to attack plants on a wide scale. And I think what he's done in this is adequately really address the issue of, you know, in terms of locust feeds and other insects and animals that have the ability to move around. Why haven't, in our ecological history, haven't these mobile species essentially stripped the planet clean of these plants? You know, if you talk about ecology, a lot of times in introductory ecology, you'll do the fox-rabbit interplay, that if there is an overpopulation of rabbits, typically the population of foxes will respond because there's a lot to feed on. But sometimes what happens is there's overfeeding, there becomes lack of food, the foxes starve, they die off, and it gives the population of rabbits the ability to increase because of less predatory pressure. It's also been identified in the context of marine animals with sharks and minnows in terms of food and feed relationships. As it turns out, plants dominate the landscape, hence plants must be broadly toxic with respect to animals as food and toxic in the widest sense. What we see is that the fact that we have not stripped the planet clean via animal predation on plants suggests that plants, in fact, have the ability to fight back. And so we're going to explore how plants have the ability to fight back in terms of some of their toxins, some of their strategies, and I'm sure this is a complex part of the reproductive and survival ecology of plants. Somehow overcoming this defense strategy of plants by insects and herbivores on the other side of the coin is a part of their survival strategy. So, for example, you've probably heard of various toxic plants that if we eat them, they're toxic. But if certain other types of animals eat them, it is relatively non-toxic to them. And we'll talk about those in a couple of case studies. Now, what are these broad category of secondary plant compounds? This is an important thing to kind of understand. These are chemicals that aren't the molecules of life. They're not the energy chemicals. These are a range of chemicals, and they're high in diversity in terms of types and forms of chemical structures. They're developed, according to a hypothesis, in plants as a part of their survival mechanism. And so it can be a part of their offensive and defensive biosynthesis processes. If we take a look at some of these compounds, and this is by no means a complete list, this is just to kind of introduce you and alert you to some of these secondary plant chemical compounds, some of them that actually exist in your daily diet. We've talked about alkaloids. Sometimes these can be toxic, sometimes bitter. We talked about them, and you may know that they exist in the Solanae family, like tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant, all have these alkaloids in them. Our current cultivars have been developed to reduce the concentrations of alkaloids in these crops. In the 1800s, tomatoes and to a large extent potatoes were considered to be poisonous by many people. And it had a lot to do with the fact that the alkaloid levels were high enough that it would give many people headaches at a minimum. But these were reasonably neurotoxic alkaloids that appear in what we consider to be a common foodstuff today. There are very poisonous alkaloids, and there are other alkaloids that are not so toxic. We've talked about poison hemlock, the conine alkaloid. This is a toxic, bitter, and highly toxic poisonous substance. There are about 6,500 alkaloids, so this is a very large category, and in fact a very well-researched category, especially with regards to the human food chain and some of the potential alkaloids that can appear in our foodstuffs. There are many toxic amines. We've identified about 100 of them. Often these are repellent or hallucinogenic compounds. For those of you that have watched media reports in terms of homeland security, there have been some investigations about ricin, which is an extract from castor bean. This is a naturally occurring toxic amine with a very high lethality. There are about 400 amino acids. Some of these are highly toxic. And when you think about it, how can amino acid be toxic? An amino acid, one of the prime modes of toxicity for toxic amino acids is to be incorporated into proteins and yield essentially a bad peptide, bad protein that does not have the required physiological capability of the normal synthesis and pathway. Cyanogenic glycosides appear in nature and in the human food chain. We know about 30 of them. They're poisonous not in as a parent compound, but as their derivative, which is cyanide. And what we find is that many foodstuffs have cyanogenic glycosides in them, but that we can remove these cyanogenic glycosides by proper food preparation. For example, in Latin America and in Africa, one of the major staple foodstuff is cassava. Cassava is a starchy, woody tuber root. It's not a tuber, I'm sorry, it's a woody root that is a staple foodstuff. The cyanogenic glycosides are actually leached out in a water treatment. It's soaked in water for about a day or so to leach these out and to also oxidize the cyanogenic glycosides. We also find these compounds, for example, in English ivy, in terms of plants that animals can chew on. And also, you may have heard about them in almonds, bitter almond extract, almond pits. You'll find them in lima beans, and you'll find them in the pits of many fruits, such as in the pits of apricots. Glucosinolates are acrid and bitter. They can actually be used as flavor-enhancing chemicals. Some of the glucosinolate plants that you probably have on your dining room table include horseradish, various mustards, even cabbage. The cruciferae have significant amounts of glucosinolates, not too much because they can be toxic if nothing else cause you to have an upset stomach. In terms of the terpenoids, there's many different types of these. The monoterpenes is about 1,000 structures. These are associated with pleasant smells. If you go into the Blue Mountains or the Smoky Mountains, quite often pine trees will give off some of these terpenoid volatile compounds. And in fact, they're the responsible for the smoke that you see. The haze that you see in the Smoky Mountains is actually the volatiles coming off of those pine trees. You can have sesquiterpene lactones. These are sometimes bitter and toxic. These are associated with many flowering weeds. Diterpenoids is about 2,000. Some of these can be toxic. Limonoids, some of these are bitter. You've probably used a recipe that says use lemon zest or the outside, grated outside of a lemon or an orange. These limonoids are the bitterness that is very good in some recipes, but it does have a bitter and sometimes toxic effect. Cucurbitacins are bitter and toxic. These compounds sometimes are phenolics. Cucumber peel has been used as a repellent and a natural insect repellent. Old wives' tale says put peels of cucumbers underneath your sink to keep cockroaches away. The cardinoids, some of these are toxic and bitter. We'll talk about how they are used in terms of plants such as the milkweed in terms of ecological biochemistry, an example here. The carotenoids give us color. It's why we have orange carrots. These color compounds sometimes have very good antioxidant properties. It's one of the reasons mom tells you to eat your fruits and vegetables. It's because of some of the compounds, these secondary chemical compounds in plants that actually do have antioxidant activity. Another category, and again, this is not a very inclusive list, it's just an example list. There are various phenolics, simple phenols that exist in nature. Some of these are antimicrobial in natural medicine. If you go to most herbal shops, organic food stores, and even some natural food markets, you'll see various products that have taken advantage of the antimicrobial activity of various plant extracts. And think about this, why would a plant extract be antimicrobial? Well, it is a part of this chemical warfare strategy of plants versus microbes. Microbes are just another form of life in this competitive strategy for survival. Flavonoids, some of these are colored. There are many compounds. Many of these have flavor capability, capacity. Many of these have antioxidant and anti-cancer capability. The diversity of the compounds are sometimes associated with many sort of secondary effects in terms of human health and our diet. Quinones, sometimes colored and toxic, about 800 compounds, again, of these phenols. Some of these have various types of activity. The toxin in poison ivy is a phenolic compound. Here's an example for you how we can kind of follow this concept through in terms of a plant-plant interaction. There's a term, allelopathy, and these are biochemical interactions between all types of plants, and so this is a chemical-chemical interaction. In history, since the time of ancient Greece, the walnut tree has been observed to kill nearby vegetation. If you don't believe this, next time you see a walnut tree, look at the diversity of flora below it. You'll see that quite often there's not a lot growing, especially when you're talking about a walnut tree that's growing in nature. There is some chemical compounds in this tree and the leaves of this tree that is moderately toxic to some insects, horses, dogs, and humans. I was associated with a veterinary toxicology case of some folks that were using walnut shells chewed up as sawdust for bedding for horses. This contact dermatitis that developed in the horses in terms of inflamed hoof was pretty significant. So this has some dermal potency as well. Walnut trees produce a bound form of a toxin which then deposits to nearby soil. It deposits through leaves, stems, and roots associated with the walnut tree. The leaching of this compound, and this compound is called jugolone. It's a powerful herbicide. It's a bound formed. It does hydrolyze and oxidize to the free form. It's a 5-hydroxynaphthoquinone compound. This is the active ingredient. This does, in fact, limit the production of competitive vegetation. And when you think about the walnut tree is competing for the nutrients for the water in the soil underneath it, and it has come up with a strategy, if you want to hypothesize, that essentially poisons off competing vegetation or many varieties of competing vegetation. Another example is of various ways of plants and animals to harness a biosynthesis. What we have found as being kind of high on the food chain and thinking animals is that we can sometimes use these for our own ends, these secondary chemical compounds. Many of these, if you read back even in texts thousands of years old, people have witnessed nature and used nature to their own ends. They have developed various plant-based medicines, various poisons that have been used in hunting and warfare. You've probably seen the movies with the poison darts and coming from what was referred to as poison dart frogs. Various pesticides, especially there are natural and organic pesticides. In Lecture 4, we reviewed rotenone, which comes from the root of a plant, which is a very, very strong herbicide that is also used as an aquatic toxin. It will kill fish, limit their respiratory uptake. We've also used many of these chemicals as flavors. The pepper plant and black pepper was an ancient commodity in the 1400s that had close to its value in terms of rareness as gold. The picture here is of one of these poison dart frogs. This is Phyllobatus terribilis. It produces bacrotoxin. This is a steroidal alkaloid. It's secreted from glands on the skin. This is a highly toxic compound. In fact, if you do an extrapolation from animal studies, the toxicity is about 136 milligrams of this. The lethal dose is about 136 milligrams of this steroidal alkaloid for a 150-pound human. So this is about a dose about the size of a sand grain. So this is a highly toxic neuromuscular inhibitor, a highly toxic chemical compound, natural chemical compound. We have also in the plant and animal kingdom relationships that we observe from microbiology. This is an example of how humans have harnessed some of the biosynthesis of nature. This is a very interesting story, and you probably have heard and seen about the medicine hunters that will look for new plant and animal chemicals, base chemicals, in the jungle and the Amazon depths and marine resources. This particular case had to do with a Dow chemical scientist who actually, whenever he went on vacation, would always bring back soil samples from the exotic places wherever he went, and this particular soil sample came from Hawaii. And this microbiologist would then isolate the local bacteria in that soil. In this particular case, he isolated soil actinomycete, Saccharopolyspora spinosa. This particular microbe actually produces a chemical compound, spinosyn, and essentially the story goes, this particular compound was identified as a particularly toxic compound against chewing worms. It causes rapid excitation of the insect nervous system, so it's a neurotoxin. It had very good off-target effects. It was non-toxic or moderately toxic to fish and animals. And it also, as a natural compound, had the property of rapid biodegradation. Now, in terms of agricultural chemicals, if you can produce an insecticide which has low off-target effects, it's relatively non-toxic, and it has rapid biodegradation, you have achieved much in terms of our quest for safer agricultural chemicals. This particular chemical, spinosad, is in current production. It's actually used in many vegetables. This is kind of what the structure looks like. And in fact, they took the basic natural substance and from a synthesis point of view, created two different varieties, spinosyn A and spinosyn D. But again, a chemical of natural origin. This is where a chemical company looked to nature as being the progenitor of a synthetic method to manage insect infestation in vegetable crops. We also find that organisms have the ability to detoxify. We've seen that in humans in lecture 8. We have the ability to adapt to various natural and unnatural chemicals through biotransformation. Some of these can actually be evolutionary, but also acclimatization processes, especially you've probably heard the phrase, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. In fact, this is the concept of acclimatization. Some of these detoxification pathways include pathways for metabolism and biotransformation of toxicants, and so we go back to phase one and phase two. And we can also look at the immune system, especially when we're dealing with large molecules, molecules that have molecular weights typically greater than 500, 600 that will induce an immune response as opposed to a direct chemical transformation. These processes include microbial biodegradation and various biomineralization processes. We can also look at plants and animals detoxifying via a phase change. Remember that if our biotransformation changes it to a volatile compound, we can exhale it. Our breath may smell like garlic, but we are perhaps volatilizing some of the sulfur compounds that might have been potentially toxic. We can also sequester various toxicants through its relative solubility in adipose tissue, or in the case of inorganics, those can be sequestered in bone tissue as being two of the prime vectors for sequestration. Recalling our discussions about phase one and phase two, these are primary pathways in animals. Phase two include glucuronide or sulfate formation. We try to attach larger, highly polar substrates in a conjugation reaction. In plants, glucoside formation is the key detoxification, phase two detoxification reaction. So we can follow some of those same sorts of biotransformation pathways, but in plants, typically we're going to find a sugar conjugation happening. This is carried out by glucosyl transferase enzyme and a uridine diphosphate glucose as a cofactor in plants. These are very water-soluble metabolites, and these are pushed out into the cell vacuole for elimination. Some of these highly phytotoxic phenols that can happen in nature, these chemical compounds, can undergo this glucosylation. There are systemic fungicidal anti-chemicals, there are the potential for the formation of anti-metabolites in these glucoside forms as well. In some plants, those of you that come from an agricultural background know that there are some types of herbicides that you can put out on crops, or if you're a homeowner and you're using certain types of herbicides, you note that you can put weed killers out on your lawn that kills the weeds but not the grass. So there is some selectivity or selective ability for herbicides to be effective or herbicidal against certain types of plants, but other types of plants it's somewhat innocuous. An example of this is 2,4-D, 2,4-dichlorophenoxyacetic acid. This is a common herbicide used for example, dandelion treatment on lawns. It is relatively non-toxic. There's some concern about it as a chlorinated herbicide. EPA has done studies and seen that, in fact, this gets tracked in off your lawn into your household. There's been some analysis in terms of mammalian toxicity and concern about lymphoma in dogs. A lot of follow-up in terms of the common use of this in residential areas as well as its use in agricultural areas. How does it work? Well, it's an extremely active auxin, which an auxin in plant terminology is a growth hormone. So if you've ever watched this, the dandelions on your lawn after application of 2,4-D, you see that in fact it takes a while to kick in, sometimes as much as a week. But what happens is the dandelion itself seems to grow very rapidly, and what happens is the plant grows beyond its nutritional capacity to provide for cell growth and structure. The colors, the growth outstrips the ability of the plant to produce energy, and in fact it grows so fast it upsets the growth cycle and kills the plant. However, some crop plants and as well your grass can degrade it, and it does so at a fast rate. How that happens, here's the chemical compound 2,4-D, and in weeds you get this abnormal plant growth. It's not detoxified immediately, it takes too long, but in, for example, in the crops of wheat and peas or in grasses in general, it detoxifies to this particular phenolic compound, and finally it adds the sugar onto it for elimination. And so it's biotransforming, it's detoxifying, and has the ability. And so some species will do this, other species don't do this, and so we have species selectivity of this particular herbicide. This is an interesting example. This is fluorocitrate in kangaroos, and we've talked about fluorocitrate and or the compound 1080 several times in the course as an example of a chemical. We went through its action on the Krebs cycle in terms of biotransformation lecture. This is an interesting case study because, as I said at that time, fluorocitrate is actually a naturally occurring chemical compound. It occurs in pasture plants, in this case, in Western Australia. It also occurs in several plants in South America. In Western Australia, the plants are Gastrolobium and Oxylobium. This chemical compound, to recall, is highly lethal. The toxic dose is 1 milligram for a 1,080 kilogram, a 2,000-pound animal. And so this is, again, a highly lethal chemical compound. And we talked about how fluorocitrate essentially shuts down the Krebs energy cycle. Interestingly enough, we find that the rat and gray kangaroo of Western Australia have evolved resistance to this particular chemical compound. So there has been evolutionary adaptation of the animals that grow up around this. The idea here is that if you haven't, you have a very short lifespan indeed if you happen to feed off this particular chemical. And so there was, over the evolutionary history of this species, some selection for those animals that can biotransform or degrade fluorocitrate. They do it with in vivo defluorination with glutathione, so they actually do have a metabolic pathway that has been identified to detoxify this particular chemical. Interestingly enough, we find that if we look at kangaroos from other parts of Australia, eastern Australia, same species of kangaroos, they have not developed this tolerance, if they have grown up or evolved in areas without those particular plants, and so they don't have this tolerance. Now, another section of our biochemical adaptation and transformation has to do with microbial processes. These are our smallest animals. Microbial biotransformation and biodegradation is a part of the system of turnover of chemicals on a very small or microscopic basis. These are microbe-induced changes or breakdowns of various natural and or synthetic chemical compounds. Some of these can be xenobiotic contaminants and some are not. The dose is very important in terms of biocidal activity. Some toxins can have the capacity to kill off a large amount of the microbe population, but leave some stragglers behind. Sometimes these stragglers have a different metabolism, and so there is a potential for selection of these microbes. We visit this potential every time we use antibiotics. What the physician and the pharmacist will tell you is to take your dose, take all of your doses for the full effect. The idea is to eliminate as best possible all of the microbes so that the ones that are resistant to that antibiotic are not the ones that remain and therefore continue an increase in population and its infectious pathogenesis. Some of the causes, why do microbes do this? They do it to detoxify their local environment. They do it also for nutrition. You present microbes with a chemical compound that has some level of toxicity, but that is all that it's exposed to in terms of oxidizable carbon sources. What happens is there will be a short-term evolution, a mutational process that they, again, turn this into food. There are other pathways that include the ability to use these chemicals as terminal electron acceptors for respiration, and sometimes that has the ability to detoxify the environment as well. What are some of the factors associated with microbial activity and chemical compounds? The fact that we have a high degree of evolutionary diversification in the microbial population. On a relative basis, we have a very high specific surface area. We have a high rate of population turnover in microbes. The survival of tolerant and acclimatized organisms is significant in terms of setting the the diversity for the next generations. And there can, because of the way of reproduction in microbes, can be a heritable change in these population characteristics. Some of the key processes involved with biodegradation, biomineralization, are enzymatic and, as I said, are respiratory in various changes associated with chemical environments of microbes. These enzyme processes are catalytic reactions. The respiratory processes are thermodynamic reactions. Aerobic, bacteria, aerobes, they use oxygen as a terminal electron acceptor in respiration. But anaerobic bacteria use a variety of other chemical compounds as terminal electron acceptors. They can use nitrate, they can use manganese, ferric iron, sulfate. You know, you've heard the term perhaps sulfate-reducing bacteria. That's what gives us the stinky sulfur rotten egg smell in many anaerobic muds. And sometimes CO2 as well. These anaerobic and aerobic bacteria help modulate various biogeochemical redox reactions. These redox reactions can have the ability to sequester heavy metals. So for example, we talked about the process of sulfate-reducing bacteria interacting with selenium and providing for an anaerobic terminal electron acceptor process to sequester selenium. But that same type of bacteria can also produce sulfide, which will impact dissolved heavy metals like lead, mercury, zinc, and produce metal sulfides, which are also insoluble. Insoluble but oxidizable, so as long as this area of the environment is maintained as anaerobic, it is predominantly insoluble. But if we turn over that soil in agriculture or in mining operations, we have the ability to introduce oxygen, to oxidize these reduced substrates and then free the heavy metals. Therein lies some of the problems associated with heavy metal release in these anthropogenic activities. Some of these bacteria processes detoxify in the same way that we've learned in terms of phase one, phase two type processes. The same goal exists as it does in us, to identify it or render it less or non-toxic. And it also helps that as they're rendering it non-toxic, they make it less toxic for us as well. For example, when bacteria dehalogenate PCBs, we learned that these polychlorinated chemical compounds typically have higher toxicity with chlorination. As they dechlorinate it and degrade it, they can reduce the toxicity. They can also change its physical properties in terms of volatility as well. As I've defined before, biomineralization will take this chemical process of an organic chemical and mineralize it or oxidize it totally to carbon dioxide and water. So it takes it all the way through as a substrate. And so this is typically regarded as a good thing. There can be a process, and if you're a microbial ecologist study biodegradation associated with microbiology, you have probably heard the term co-metabolism. Co-metabolism is the gratuitous oxidation of a chemical by an organism, so it's not using it for energy recovery. Sometimes it just happens because it's in a highly oxidized environment via the chemical turnover of the bacteria itself, and so it's typically a chemical-to-chemical interaction, not an interaction of the chemical with the microbe itself. And so the microbe is changing the environment, and sometimes that helps oxidize the local environment and oxidize the chemicals that are around it. We can use this strategy, the fact that microbes can eat, if you will, toxic compounds in the process called bioremediation. This typically is an engineered strategy, even if it is an intrinsic bioremediation where we look at natural processes. Typically these are in situ. If you've ever been on an industrial site that uses a lot of heavy equipment repeatedly, things like mining sites are an example. They use big trucks, big tractors, shovels. There are fuel leaks, there are hydraulic leaks, and so there is contamination of soil. Currently, the way we manage that in terms of regulatory RCRA requirements is these companies are required to shovel up that soil, and quite often they take it to what's called a land farming operation. So they deposit all this oil-contaminated soil in a contained environment, and then they do nothing but sometimes add a little bit of fertilizer and turn it over and keep it very oxidized and let natural processes start chewing on these reduced hydrocarbons to biodegrade this. It's a land farming approach to remediation of these oil contaminated soils. We can also have a process of biostimulation, and this is where we're going to add nutrients to speed it up, because sometimes the microbes might need a little bit more than what you're feeding it to do it at an acceptable rate of turnover or remediation. We can also use a process called bioaugmentation. And this happens, for example, when the local microbial ecology is unsatisfactory in terms of turning over or remediating this particular chemical compound. And so you can take some soil or some inocula from other places, for instance, petroleum degraders might be a very high concentration in a land farm. You want to start a land farm somewhere else, you might inoculate them to kind of kick it over and help it along. The fact that microbes use enzymes and enzymatic processes in degradation is fortuitous, because we can then isolate these enzymes from fermenters, harvest them, if you will, and then just use the enzymes from these cultures in various engineered treatments of chemical waste. And so these are some of the ways that we have learned to marshal the forces of microbial nature to achieve our ends of engineering a response to some of the messes that we leave in terms of soil and water contamination. Another strategy that an organism might have is a phase change strategy. And this is where a chemical change is going to happen because of typically enzymatic processes that allow for a reduction in toxicity and an increase in the elimination rate. An example of this would be the volatilization of various bioalkylated metals and metalloids by microbes and plants. We don't necessarily think of arsenic, selenium, lead, mercury, and antimony as volatile. We think of them as heavy metals, but in fact we can create volatile methyl mercury, which is one of the parts of the biogeochemical cycle of mercury. And we do that via microbial processes, by fungal processes, by plant processes. And so what we have hypothesized is that this volatilization is a part of the strategy of the organism to detoxify its local environment. We can also find that there are some processes of sequestration and bioaccumulation that an organism will use in terms of managing its local environment. We've talked about mammalian incorporation of lead into bone, plant incorporation of selenium into these amino acids, sometimes non-protein amino acids as a survival strategy. We talked as well in our selenium discussions about the microbial reduction of the oxyanions of selenium into the selenium zero, which is a solid, relatively non-soluble solid, and then that would be incorporated into the solid portions of the cell, sequestered away. In fact, microbial scientists that microbiologists that have examined selenium reducing microbiology have also deduced that there are some cells that appear to be somewhat suicidal in a population of cells that hyperaccumulate the selenium zero to the point of lethality, essentially sacrificing themselves as pawns for the population. This is a part of a population process, this terminator suicidal cell. Some of this sequestration and bioaccumulation in plants can be used for hazardous site waste cleanup. You may have heard the term phytoremediation. There are various plants that have been planted, cultivated on contaminated soils or in contaminated waters, if they're aquatic plants. And these plants selectively hyperaccumulate a heavy metal, typically something like lead or zinc. These plants can then be harvested. They've cleaned the soil, and then the plants themselves can be, for example, incinerated or had the go through a next step of being buried in a hazardous waste site, cleaning up the soil, decreasing the contamination level. There can be also some organic examples. This can be the accumulation of nonpolar compounds such as DDT and dioxins in adipose tissue. There are, as these plants and animals sequester and bioaccumulate, you can see these processes up a food chain. What we observe in organic compounds quite often is the concept of bioaccumulation factors or bioconcentration factors. We can find these concentrations to increase up a food chain by a factor of 100 to 1,000, some cases even 10,000. Sometimes this can have dramatic impacts in terms of top of the food chain ecology. If in fact the concentration magnifies up the food chain, it may not be at a toxic level at the lower ends of the food chain, but it may have dramatic impacts and toxicity at the upper part of the food chain. An example of this is PCB biomagnification. This is in the Great Lakes, actually. This is a lake food chain. If you look at this graphic here, in terms of the concentration and the relative magnification here, phytoplankton to zooplankton and get about a 50-fold concentration increase, magnification. As you go to smelt, small feeder fish, a factor of 416. Larger predatory fish, a factor of almost 2,000 above the phytoplankton. And then because we have predatory birds feeding on the food chain, we get a factor of, in this case, 50,000. At these high concentrations, then we start seeing things like eggshell thinning, teratogenesis, immune dysfunction, all of the associated chlorinated hydrocarbon type compound end effects, toxic end effects that we discussed in the dioxin-related compounds lecture in the course. This is an example I'm going to talk about here for the next remaining, a couple of examples for the remaining part of the lecture, of ecological biochemical interaction. This is associated with the transfer of these biosynthesized secondary compounds between different organisms. And so these are not toxins in the environment in terms of anthropogenic toxins that bioaccumulate and transfer among species. These are chemical compounds that are biosynthesized by typically one of the species in this interaction. And this happens because of food web interactions, and it is hypothesized and seen in terms of wildlife studies to be a part of the survival strategy of the individual species. There appears to be some symbiotic relationship between very diverse species in some of these cases. One of the cases we're going to talk about is the milkweed plant, monarch butterfly, and blue jay bird plant animal interaction. This is one of the classic examples of plant animal coevolution. And this is the insects are using plant toxins against high predators. What we find is that these plants, typically milkweed or the oleander type plants, that produce these certain types of toxins have a relationship with insects that feed on them. In this particular case, we'll talk about the monarch butterfly. Note that the monarch butterfly, if you're not a butterfly person, is bright red. There's probably some evolutionary significance to its coloring in terms of alerting potential predators about what it feeds on. And then finally, the blue jay and the relationship of the blue jay to the insects and plants in this particular threefold relationship. What I've done here on this slide is illustrate the chain of events that happens in this relationship. The milkweed produces these bitter, toxic cardiac glycosides as a passive defense. And so these cardiac glycosides are actually toxic, potentially they increase heart rate in a very rapid way. In fact, there are some plants that produce cardiac glycosides that we, in fact, have developed some heart medicines from. What we find is that the feeding monarch butterfly caterpillar is well adapted to these toxins and actually stores them. So it bioaccumulates or accumulates them selectively. The adult butterfly then flies away and it has these sequestered cardiac glycosides within its body tissues. And then you have a blue jay coming along and they see this attractive, brightly colored butterfly. It catches their attention and says, "There's lunch for me." The blue jay tries feeding on these brightly colored butterflies. It's bitter, it's toxic. The blue jay vomits. It doesn't turn out so well for the particular butterfly, but for the rest of the butterflies, that blue jay isn't necessarily going to consider that to be a food source, and so in the future avoids those brightly colored monarch butterflies. So there's a system, a relationship, plant-animal relationship here in terms of a coevolution strategy. The cardiac glycosides, just to give you an idea of the complexity and the shape and size of these molecules, calotropin from the milkweed, oleandrin from the oleander plant. The oleander plant, if you're ever driven in California, There's typically brightly colored highway plants in the middle, sometimes dividers. They have red, pink, or white flowers. They're wonderfully tolerant Mediterranean plants, but they do contain these cardiac glycosides. An interesting story for you. I was involved in a veterinary diagnostic toxicology case workup in California, actually. What happened was a semi-tractor trailer of sugar beets overturned on a California freeway, made a mess, scattering the sugar beets all over the highway, blocked traffic, and the Caltrans people, the people that maintain the freeway, had to come in with big shovels and scoop up all the sugar beets, bring them in another truck, and kind of haul them out of there. They actually did continue on their way to a sugar plant. They did enter processing, and then someone noticed there was a problem, and it was a problem because the sugar beet pulp after sugar extraction, which is a hot water extraction, was being fed to animals, and they noticed that there was a significant amount of these oleander plants that had also been scraped up into the sugar beets and therefore came out in the beet pulp. These cardiac glycosides are toxic to animals. The sugar plant itself had already processed these into their main main processing stream. They had to shut it down, flush the entire plant, dump a whole week's worth of sugar in response to the potential presentation of cardiac glycosides into the human food chain. A very unfortunate situation for all involved. Next ecological biochemistry example we'll talk about is Ciguatera fish poisoning. This is the most commonly reported marine toxic disease in the world. It's associated with the consumption of contaminated reef fish. The vector fish are typically high on the aquatic food chain, fish such as barracuda, grouper, and snapper. There's about 50,000 victims of Ciguatera fish poisoning per year. The pathogenesis of this disease is a debilitating neurologic symptoms, includes profound weakness, temperature sensation, various pains and numbness in the extremities. How this comes to us is through the presentation in the food chain of ciguatoxin. Ciguatoxin is produced by the dinoflagellate Gambardiscus toxicus. It produces this particular toxin throughout the world. This biomagnifies up the food chain. The most common toxins associated with Ciguatera are ciguatoxin and mitotoxin. These have been identified as some of the most lethal natural substances known. The mice LD50 from an interperitoneal injection, this is an injection into the abdominal cavity, is 0.45 micrograms per kilogram, so less than a microgram per kilogram is lethal. Ciguatoxin is lipid soluble. It opens the voltage-dependent sodium channels in cell membranes. It induces, therefore, membrane depolarization. What we find in terms of human consumption is lethality is seen when we have individuals that ingest the most toxic parts of the fish. Not that many people eat fish liver or fish gonads, but these are associated with high degree of accumulation of this particular toxin. The ciguatoxin molecule, again, just to kind of highlight and illustrate for you what these toxins look like. This is also a macrolid, multi-polycyclic molecule. It's interesting to give you a respect for nature, how biosynthesis can be quite complex in terms of some of the molecules that present in the natural world. Our final example here in this ecological biochemistry lecture is going to be the relationship of various types of moths with pyrrolizidine alkaloids. Pyrrolizidine alkaloids are a type of alkaloids. They're hepatotoxic. They cause of veno-occlusive disease, and we find them actually in many plants, including groundsel, senecio, as you can see in this particular plant. This is a common plant in the United States, a common weed variety. Ragwort is another one. The relationship for pyrrolizidine alkaloids is with the moth, typically tiger moth or cinnabar moth, in terms of the relationships of this plant with these insects. What we find with these senecio alkaloids, that these highly toxic PAs or pyrrolizidine alkaloids are found in the various species of the genus senecio. They are poisonous to foraging wildlife. Life and livestock. They're very strong hepatotoxins. Sometimes you can go into a herbal store or a natural food store and still find occasionally comfrey tea. Comfrey is a plant. I have it growing in my garden, my herb garden. It is typically used in natural medicine as an astringent, as a surface medical treatment, although it has had historical use as a tea. Probably not a good thing, and this is actually represents one of the largest risks associated with the use of herbal products. Herbal products are not managed as medicines. They're not managed by the FDA. What you take as an herbal product is whatever the manufacturer decides they want to put into it. The oversight is non-existent in for many. I'm not trying to essentially damn the herbal market. I think there are some wonderful products out there, but there are also some extraordinarily risky products out there. Risky in terms of what actually comes to play in some of these teas. In mammals, pyrrolizidine alkaloids, this is the general shape and structure of it. It's a large ester with this alkaloid, pyrrolizidine alkaloid functionality here. There's hydrolysis to retronessine, some chemical changes down to hydroxyhex-2-enol. This particular compound is hepatotoxic. It binds to liver, again causes some of the problems. Pyrrolizidine alkaloids are regarded as carcinogens and hepatotoxins, and this is the mode of toxicity associated with this particular chemical in mammals. In the senecio moth interaction, these pyrrolizidine alkaloids from the plants that they feed on are actually sequestered and stored by the moths. The moths, interestingly enough, can biotransform one alkaloid in vivo within themselves into another. They find that toxic alkaloids, these senecio alkaloids, are present in the insect eggs as well. And these moths, the tiger moth and others, have bright colors and patterns. Again, the idea here is that it's warning potential predators that I'm a toxic meal. Interestingly enough, these moths will also feed on foxgloves, Digitalis purpurea. It's another source of cardiac glycosides. Some of you may know relatives that are on a heart medicine that goes by the name of Digitalis, which is a derivative of this cardiac glycoside. Well, in Lepidoptera or butterflies and moths, there's a different pyrrolizidine alkaloid metabolism. What we find is that this chemical compound, the PAs, can get stored in the tissues of butterflies and moths. There can be hydrolysis of that compound, again, to retronessine. But the next step in Lepidoptera is a pheromone synthesis. That pheromone synthesis ends up with three different products here, all from the same basic chemical alkaloid substrate. Interestingly enough, these three chemicals have a purpose. These purposes in mammals, it actually goes to the pyrrole, which can bind with DNA and can break down to these reactive metabolites, hepatotoxins, and carcinogens. But in Lepidoptera, the pyrrolizidine alkaloids actually act as essential pheromone precursors. So the biotransformation in these tiger moths are actually to a love dust that these animals use to interact with each other. So therein gives you a good background for ecological biochemistry. The idea here being that the natural world does present us with toxic challenges. As predators on the food chain, we have the potential to be presented with those toxins just through our normal and natural. But on the other hand, I think it's important to regard the secondary chemical compounds in plants and sometimes in animals as well, in terms of bioaccumulation, as also as necessary chemicals in terms of making our diets interesting, in terms of the color of our foods, the taste sensations of our foods, and also our ability to use these models for medicines and for understanding the natural environment around us. Until next time, we'll see you. Thanks much.